Ethel Dobson is coming from a medical background and very interested in how religion and spirituality can be implemented in daily practice. This will be the topic of our free communication session today. We have four presentations, four speakers. So every speaker will have 20 minutes. Please don't speak for 15 minutes and leave at least 5 minutes for discussion. We'll start with the first presentation. That's Dr. Anahita Pawarasulyan from, she's a PhD student at the University of Vienna, and she will share with us about religious convictions of my patients, Australian medical students' point of view. Please, Anahita.
Hello, my name is Paola Rasulian. I'm from Austria. Thank you, René, for introducing me, and thank you all for coming. I hope we will have an interesting session, and we will be on time. I will hurry up, even I need to talk a bit slower. To introduce myself, I'm originally from Germany, but I work as a doctor in the oncology in the medical university in Vienna, in a hospital, and I'm also a PhD student in mental health, and by my working as an oncology, I'm working with patients, terminal ill patients, facing death a lot of times. I also face the spiritual needs of my patients. And I just reflect, are we physicians are aware enough, or are we competent enough to facing these issues? My slides. Maybe I should talk my... Yeah, the video is also part of my presentation. But anyway, what's the... I just wanted to start with what's the perception, religion, and spiritual belief of my patients. So I just wanted to give you an introduction. I hope you can hear it. Everyone was open for it, and that was the question. I thought SBS doctors are really open to talk with our patients. Especially, we cannot compare spirituality and religiousness in Europe with the US country, where it's very normal to talk about these issues. I mean, working in a university hospital, it's not so often to talk about. That's why we created a study Thank you for my presentation. So what is the religious conviction spirituality of my patient? I just wanted to give you a small answer with this, with the videos. And okay, Supi. I just will go ahead. And Finny, are you or me? I can do that here, yeah? If you allow, Supi. Okay, I'm just need to try to be on time because Donia said we should be on the bus. Okay, background. We just know, lots of studies shown that there is a positive, important factor with patients dealing with as a resource for patients. I'm a bit nervous, sorry, I'll just go ahead. The background. So my question was, we had studies, and as we all know here, that's the reason why we're here, that there is a positive or a very important factor for patients dealing with the disease, that religiosity and spirituality might help them. Busing made a lot of studies, others showed that. And I also made some studies with my patients, but for me it was important, before we bring spiritual care to our universities, or we in the medical history are the physicians of tomorrow's students. That's why our students are really ready enough to talk with their patients about these issues. That's why I wanted to know if the students' personality, spirituality, and religious, are they religious, are they spiritual? We heard yesterday that's also an impact on how they react with their patients. Then students' opinion about spiritual care, and most important, are they open enough for these things? That's why we created a study with 1,400 students at the Medical University of Vienna, 333 from the first year, 248 second year, 393 third year, and 426 fourth year. The numbers were just how many we catched on that day when we came with the questionnaire. It was just an... Oh, I go back. So the methods, it was last year between March and June, it was just filling out a questionnaire. The questionnaire needed to be nice and clear and simple and only in 5 minutes, because to be honest, I'm a full-time worker, and also I just went in the beginning of the students' lessons and asked, can I have a questionnaire? And so it was really nice and easy to get this, if the questionnaire is nice and easy. So, okay. Okay, I will skip the questions because I will come to the questions later on the results. So the results were that 20.9% of our students, of this 1,400 students we asked, were the question was, would you consider yourself as a religious person? And the second question was, as a spiritual person? So we had 21.9% said they're religious, 20.1% said they're spiritual, and 27.5% said they're religious and spiritual. To compare, I just finished last week asked same questions to patients, oncologist patients, and the number were very similar. If you compare, we also have 24.4% religious patient on our ward, 11.6% spiritual, and 26.1% religious spiritual. So there is some religiosity and spirituality in this hospital and around the physicians. So the results also, just to give you an overview, it was close to 744 men, 646 women. The mean age was 22 because we asked from the first to the fourth year of the medical school. 4.9% ever heard of the term spiritual care. I could also say that 59.1% never heard of the term. So in Austria, it's also something really no one knows. And the second question after, if you ever heard of the term, what do you think, what is it? And it was really funny what the answers were. So mostly the students had no sense about what is spiritual care. 75.4% agreed with the statements that spirituality and religious conviction might have an effect on cancer patients' coping. It was, for me as an oncologist, very important to see, hey, there really belief that this is can be a resource. And in a second way, we should talk about how we can strengthen them in this. Anyways, 86.1 consider talking with their patients about spiritual and religious issues if patients wish to. I will come to that later. Very important is 86% said they will do it when the patient wishes to. Okay. 59.5% of the students had reflected their own belief concept. That was also something we heard the last sessions, how important it is also for a physician to reflect their own spirituality and religiosity before going in contact with a different person. 86.5% would involve pastoral care if considered necessary. I'm thankful, very blessed on our ward and also in our hospital. The chaplain is a very, very necessary and important part of our team. So he's really welcome and we're very open for that. Then the main question, to be honest, for me was, and also we talked about that yesterday, who's supposed to take care of the spiritual religious needs of patients? And 95.7% said it should be the chaplain. They could say many answers in this. I mean, that was something I thought of, but that partner and friends, and then the physicians was 56 before the nurses. That was something really surprisingly for me. Interesting, 47.9% all of them mentioned. It's also great to be at a team, and 2.5% none of them mentioned. And comparing this to the study we asked the patient, it was very similar. Mostly they wanted the partner and the friends. There was the most that they said, and certainly the chaplains, and then the physicians and the nurses. So it was very similar also, and very surprisingly these high numbers. Other results which said that 86.1% of the students would talk with their patients if they want to, but 80.4% feel religious belief as a part of medical history taking. For us it's absolutely not normal, or really, you know, we don't have that so much. But 30.53% found it difficult to talk with their patient about religiosity and spiritual themes. 40.4% found it difficult to talk about this in general, and 11.1% did not see it as necessary in total. Conclusion, Austromedica students consider spirituality and religious conviction as a potential resource for coping with cancer. A high number of students consider themselves spiritual and or religious. Students show a general openness to talk about spiritual religious issues with their patient. At the same time, they do not consider spiritual care to be primarily part of the physician's responsibility. And also, Austrian medical students find it difficult to talk about this issue. We had 35%, they said it's really difficult to talk about that. Further research, we asked students, we asked patients, now we will ask nurses and oncologists as the next step, and chaplains, just to find answers of who is in different point of views, how to face the spiritual needs of the patient, who is responsible for, who should support these needs. Thank you very much. I'm sorry, now I was a bit fast. Maybe next time I should not be the first presenter. Are there any questions? I would love to hear. Ingrid. Yeah, actually I had the slides, but I was afraid of the time. But in general there were no so big differences. They were very close. We didn't find any significant differences between the years. No. But that's a good question. We also thought it may be the... Okay, no, we couldn't see that.
Other questions?
Questionnaire, but you didn't. Are you sure?
No, I think I will answer all questions on the question, but you can have it later for me. I had it somewhere. So, yeah, we can go there. But it was the question, would you prefer yourself as a... Here. Have you ever heard of the term spiritual care? Would you consider yourself a spiritual person? Very easily questioned. That was important to have a very easy question. Other questions?
Thank you for that presentation. You said there were some very funny answers to what is spiritual care. Can you tell us what they are?
They were totally funny. Like, yeah, you're right, I should bring them. They were, so we had a lot of fun while seeing them, like talking with angels and more in this very... So Aberglaube oder so. Superstition way. But mostly no one guessed that spiritual care might be something with a health professional. Spiritual care more than work and help from other universe, whatever. Or talking about lives before. Lots of people also thought about that.
Okay, other questions?
Then I have a last one. You showed us about the religiosity of the student. And on one side, it's not so religious, but religious about 20%. Yeah. And you showed us how they think about the influence. It's much higher. How do you explain that?
The influence? What do you mean, the influence?
On
yeah, I also was surprised. I just explained, Alexis, that there was an openness. I mean, when you compare, they said 86% would talk with their patients if the patient wants to it, but on the other side, they also said, no, I don't want to talk about these topics and I wouldn't talk with anyone. So I think it's more that they, in this professional atmosphere, they would do that. But I also was surprised that so many believed that there could be a resource, but still they are not. I mean, this shows only an openness for that, in my opinion.
I think something we can't explain yet very clearly. We had that also in our session about doctors' beliefs. Doctors, they're not so religious, but they believe there is an influence.
Yeah, but we see that on the oncology part, because especially in the hematology, my patients mostly around 6 and 8 weeks on the ward, and most of them have angels and stones. And we have saw that in the video, she had stones up to her. And so we see that our Bible on the bed. So we, as doctors, every day we make the round, we see that they have something they need.
Patients.
And so maybe that's why also. Or we see that especially the religious members come and they have a support from all that.
Okay.
So we see that they cope much better. Maybe that's why. I don't know, just a suggestion.
It could be an explanation.
Okay,
thanks so much, Anahita, for the presentation. Let's go on with the second one. Professor Ann Pussing. He has a professorship for quality of life, spirituality and coping at the Faculty of Health and at the University of Wittenherdecke. He will be giving a keynote lecture tomorrow. And now he speaks on the influence of spirituality on work engagements in physicians with anthroposophic background. I'm looking forward to what you're going to tell us. Please, Jan.
Thank you. So as you've heard, I have a focus on persons with an anthroposophical background. I hope you ask, what's an anthroposophical doctor? If not... Thank you. It's not working. So it refers to Rudolf Steiner. It's a spiritual philosophy developed by Rudolf Steiner. He's from Austria, so it's meeting Poland. It's a little bit older researcher, philosopher. His idea was that the path of spiritual research in this anthroposophical orientation, and it's developed on the basis of European idealistic philosophy, mainly rooted in philosophies of Aristotle, Plato, or Thomas Aquinas. He postulates the existence of objective spiritual world. Hello? Sorry? Okay, thank you. And the important thing is that we as human beings may have access to this spiritual world. The perceptions of this world might be driven by imagination or inspiration or even intuition, and this is a trained and taught way to perceive this world. The easy information is, for me, I have no ideas how it works, but if you go on in the training way, you may perceive it. So the aim is to develop complete inner freedom based on individual insight, judgment and decisions. The research question was, how do we help professionals with an anthroposophical background, with its specific features of spirituality? Is spirituality a resource to these health professionals to deal with increasing stress and work burden, which may affect their life satisfaction, empathic encounter with patients? Specifically, are there associations between cool-down phenomena, I will explain later on what this is, and their work satisfaction, work burden, and life satisfaction? And next, is there an influence of anthroposophic spirituality on world engagement and cool-down phenomena? What are these cool-down phenomena? It might be an attitude to behave professionally neutral or less empathic, even when facing difficult medical situation or appealing fate of patients. Or, and maybe both are true, it's distancing towards patients to protect the own functionality prior, during or after emotional exhaustion. Emotional distance is implicitly regarded by most health professionals as an adequate reaction of self-protection. All nurses, all medical doctors learn to have a distance to the patients. I'm sorry, it's really annoying, this telephone calls and so on. Could you please stop it? Okay. So first, we can differentiate burnout. Burnout means dysfunctional exhaustion resulting in illness, while cool down means we have the experience of exhaustion, but emotional distancing is a reaction to stay functional. So it's a strategy to stay functional. The cool down index addresses perception of emotional exhaustion, reactions of emotional dissociation, and also working to rule as a strategy. As you can see here, there's a correlation between the Maslow burnout index and the cool-down reactions. The model was, first of all, that spirituality may have a blocking effect or protecting effect against cool-down reactions, that spirituality may have a positive effect on work engagement, that spirituality affects life satisfaction, both are associated, and cool-down reactions would have a negative impact on these variables. This was the idea. We had a cross-sectional survey supported by the medical section of the Goetheanum. This is the anthroposophical Vatican. And among different health professionals with anthroposophical background, using standardized questionnaires, using cool-down index, work engagement, the UBES, the life satisfaction, aspects of spirituality, and socio-demographic data. We had about 66 women, percent women, age 53. Most were physicians, we had some nurses, art and music therapists, arrhythmia therapists, and some others. Denominations were mainly Christ Community Church, which means this is a Christengemeinschaft of the anthroposophical scene. We had some conventional Protestants, some conventional Catholics, and some others, and 30% said, no, we are none of them. The spiritual orientation was in most cases anthroposophy or anthroposophy and Christianity or anthroposophy and Buddhism or Christianity or some Buddhists alone. So what are the aspects of spirituality? As you can see, all scores are extremely high as compared to a normal public population. You see the differences are tremendously high. Please make your own decision what's the reason for it. The important thing, there is a slight drop in the nurses, which is significant, but it's not of relevance. The same is true for transcendence conviction. There is a slight drop, but not really of relevance. So the mean scores, this is very important, are much higher as a normal population of conventional persons. Either it means these are spiritual superheroes, or simply effects of... Peace. respond by yourself. So all of them are engaged in meditation. 50% yes, meditation is quite higher for healthcare professionals. The frequency of meditation is quite high. Most of them meditate at least daily or at least weekly, several times per week. Responding to the question, confronted with some difficult medical problems, I seek help from the spiritual realm, may it be God, Christ, spiritual beings or whatsoever, through spiritual efforts such as prayer and meditation. Several would say to 41%, yes, often or always. So they seek help in these different realms. Most of them of us don't have access. Looking for the cool down index, as you can see, there are more or less moderate scores as compared to conventional hospital physicians. This means these cool down reactions are quite low in anthroposophical oriented physicians or nurses as compared to the normal population. The question, do they differ? The professions know the cool down reactions. Do not differ between the different professions. All of them have the same experiences. Quite low experiences. Are there correlations between cool-down reaction with work engagement and life satisfaction? Yes. There is a negative correlation, as can be expected, with work engagement, subscale vigor, and also there is a negative correlation with life satisfaction. While spirituality, all the different aspects of spirituality, has no relevance, some significant but not of relevant correlations between these dimensions. What are the predictors of these cool-down reactions? Very clear, a negative predictor is work satisfaction, vigor dimension, and work burden is positively associated, but not too much explained variance. Gender, age, profession were not among the significant predictors, and spirituality is not a significant predictor of reactions towards the patients. So what is spirituality good for? As you can see here, the different aspects of spirituality correlate with work engagement. How anthroposophical persons are in their job. Good correlation with vigor, dedication, absorption, and the sum score, of course. And also the frequency of meditation is associated with a religious orientation. And now the interesting point is, normally, in most cases, meditation would be moderately or at least strongly associated with conscious interaction with others and having compassion towards others. Not here. A very small correlation with the frequency of meditation. This means meditation for anthroposophical oriented person means I myself, means something within, not external relations helping others, although they do help others. But first of all, meditation is inner development. What are the associations between work engagement with cool down, life satisfaction, and spirituality? Interestingly, work engagement is associated negatively with cool down, as I've told you, but of course with life satisfaction, and again, of course, as I've told you before, dimensions of spirituality. What are the significant predictors? Predictors of vigor, best predictor is life satisfaction, but next, religious orientation, cool down reactions negative, being a medical doctor is a negative predictor for vigor in your profession, positive is also age. Similar, work engagement, subdimension, dedication is quite similar. You can see all the same effect, that life satisfaction is the best predictor and religious orientation is among the other of relevance. The same is true for absorption. Here, religious orientation is one of the good predictors. And again, being a medical doctor is a negative predictor for work engagement. This means that happiness among medical doctors is not the best. So, sum up all the results. In contrast to our expectations, spirituality is not a buffer against cool-down reactions. It means distancing towards the patients, at least in this group. There is a minor association with conscious interaction, it's quite clear, but it's not of relevance. There are more or less moderate associations that the engagement in life or in work is positively affected, and the strongest interaction is, of course, on this side. Here, cool-down reaction, of course, affect happiness in life and work engagement. So to conclude it, healthcare professionals with anthroposophical backgrounds score extremely high on all aspects of spirituality. Their spirituality does not necessarily contribute to their general life satisfaction, and in fact only 5% of life satisfaction is explained by all variables of spirituality. Health professional spirituality might not be a buffer against cool-down reaction, but against loss of vigor and dedication in the work. I think this is important, and this is the final statement. Thanks for listening.
Yeah, thank you, Professor Büssing, for this nice and quick presentation. Yeah. Other questions?
I have one.
You showed us that their spirituality doesn't relate with their life satisfaction. Could this be also the expression of the characteristic of the spirituality, which is maybe not oriented towards life satisfaction but personal development?
Good question. Are there any anthroposophics here in the room? No? Okay. Sorry.
Okay.
I mean, please don't listen. It might be, if we have such high scores of spirituality, the variance is limited. The same study in conventional medical doctors might be different. It might be that these spiritual that these persons with a very exclusive spirituality and such high scores are really convicted, I've made it. And because they've made it, they're happy with their life, but there is no variance within it. This could be one of the explanations because it's a methodological problem. Their life satisfaction is quite high, their spirituality is quite high. But nevertheless, in all other studies with patients or with conventional medical doctors, there is a small association between the relational aspects of spirituality and life satisfaction, not with the faith components or the conventional religious associations, at least in German populations. It might be an explanation.
Thank you. Maybe you would like to ask something?
I wanted to ask actually something. I would like to know your explanation for this high score. How do you explain this high score of spirituality, and does this spirituality have effects on the acting with patients?
Yeah, that's a good question. We were surprised that the associations with the relational aspects were not too strong. We do know that most of anthroposophical doctors have very specific connection to transcendent realms, which are thought or they're convinced that they have positive impact how they make diagnosis, how they find therapies, and how they treat patients. However, we can't see a correlation with these measures we have investigated. I really can't say whether it's only simply self-overestimation. I suppose yes. Because we had an oversampling among students which all have a very high score of spirituality and low scores on conventional religiosity, and they show similar data of too high expectations. I am a realized
aspirant to being or whatsoever. It might be that this is nothing else.
Thank you. One last question?
No.
Okay. Thank you again. So we are coming to our third presentation. I would like to introduce Bernice Tai. I did it spell properly. Bernice Tai. She is a senior lecturer in dietetics at the Coventry University in UK, one of these nice and big group from Coventry. Thank you for being here with us and presenting on the topic of emotion, work associated with personal faith. Thank you.
Okay, so yes, my title is Emotion Work Associated with Personal Faith. But I thought I'd introduce you to Coventry and Coventry University first of all. So, there we are. Sort of south-ish of the UK. I'm a southerner, so we're in the middle really, sort of in the middle of England, but the UK as a whole. And it's a lovely university, and the old cathedral. And conforming to the British stereotype of always talking about the weather, that's the weather forecast for the week in Coventry, so I'm just pleased to be here. So, I thought it might be helpful to talk a little bit about background, just to define some terms and talk a little bit about my research. So, as I say, my title is Emotion Work Associated with Personal Faith. And emotion work is the modification of emotions that enable health professionals to undertake... Emotion work is the modification of emotions which health professionals undertake in order to enable patients to feel cared for and to conform to organisational rules. So it's related to emotional labour. Emotional labour is a term that's used quite often, and it's part of emotional labour. They're all related. And I particularly like this cartoon from the BMJ. As health professionals, I'm sure you can all relate to this. There may be times when you're with a patient and you know you should be caring, and sometimes that's difficult to do. Not necessarily because of the patient, often because of what's going on in your life, you're tired, whatever it might be. So you put on a mask, and that is undertaking emotion work. So my research was looking at dietitians' involvement in decision-making related to artificial nutrition and hydration. So tube feeding, basically. And I was asking them about decisions that they may be directly involved with actually making the decision, or they may be involved in the team discussion, or may be involved in implementing a decision. And sometimes that's difficult for dietitians when you're not directly involved in making that decision and you're implementing that decision. So they may be decisions like who to feed, what to feed, how much to feed, very straightforward decisions, to more complex decisions about withholding or withdrawing artificial nutrition, particularly if nutrition is seen as futile. And obviously artificial feeding has very deep emotional and religious connotations, as shown by an article that was on the BBC website not that long ago, where the article used the very emotive term starved. So nutrition was withdrawn from the patient because it was seen as being futile, but using the word starved is obviously very emotive because we use for food for nurture, to show we're caring for people. So I interviewed 16 dietitians twice, qualitative phenomenological study. I used convenient sampling, but was very lucky to get a range of dietitians. So I had senior dietitians, junior dietitians. The years of experience range from about a year to about 35 years. Community settings, hospital settings, range of different backgrounds, and analysed them phenomenologically. One of the major findings that came out was that dietitians were really faced with very emotive situations. And this wasn't just related to end-of-life situations or withdrawing nutrition. It was very much related to their everyday clinical practice. and they needed to manage these emotions in some way. And we know, as health professionals, that actually managing those emotions takes effort. So emotion work emerged as one of the themes from my research. And for some of my participants, it was related to their personal beliefs. So for some, it was hiding their true emotions. They felt very negative about the situations they found themselves in. And that was because they were conforming to what they believed to be professional norms or organisational norms. They were conforming to display rules. So the organisational norms saying you can't get upset in front of the patient. Which is interesting, I think. Where that comes from, I really don't know. But, you know, the perceived wisdom is that you can't show your emotions to patients. So I'm going to talk about one dietitian's experience. So I'm holding my hands up here and saying this is just one person's experience. I am going to try and draw wider implications later, but this is just one person's. And I would be very interested to hear if you have similar experiences yourself or it resonates with you at all. So one dietitian's experience of emotion work related to her Christian beliefs is what I'm going to talk about. So this dietitian talked about feeling conflicted about tube feeding patients she believed were dying or were suffering. She said, "Am I just prolonging someone's life an extra couple of weeks and prolonging their pain for no other reason than I'm feeding them? I struggle with that quite a lot." So because her role as a dietitian is providing that nutrition, whether she agreed with the decision or not, she is involved in that patient's care, so therefore that troubled her, that perhaps she was contributing to his pain, his suffering. And these emotions seem to be rooted in her faith, and her view that patients were suffering, and from her Christian viewpoint, that patients shouldn't be suffering. She said, "Part of me thinks, for the quality of life they have, is it really worth feeding them and keeping them alive this long? I just think it's quite sad, really. I suppose what my belief would be to let the patient go to a better place. Maybe that's to do with me being a Christian." So this dietitian had to modify her emotions. She couldn't show that she was troubled. She couldn't show that she was concerned because she feared the repercussions for her as a professional. She said, "Obviously, that's something you can't express with a patient. We live in a world where you say one thing wrong and the next thing you're in the newspapers or you're brought up in front of head of department." Now, obviously, this is a UK dietitian, and I'm sure for people in other areas, you may be thinking, oh, that's all a bit strange. But there has been high-profile cases in the UK with a nurse being disciplined and a doctor being investigated as far as offering to pray for patients. So she thought she was very mindful of that. She didn't want to express that view because she thought she may get in trouble. So it's a dietitian who's conflicted between her faith and her practice. She's a dietitian, so it's her job to provide nutrition, so she's doing that, but her faith is saying, no, we shouldn't be doing this. So she's clearly conflicted. She can't say anything about it because the organisational norms say that she mustn't, and she's fearful of repercussions. So does it matter? I think yes. Emotion work can affect patients and health professionals. So as far as patients go, the literature is a bit mixed as to whether it's a benefit or a harm for patients. Certainly modifying emotions may be beneficial for patients if it's showing that we have emotional intelligence as health professionals, we're being aware that we have to show appropriate emotions in the workplace. It might be helpful as far as therapeutic relationships. Emotional work is sometimes needed to show empathy. If you really are struggling, then you may need to emotional work to show empathy and to show you're caring for your patients. And if patients believe that they are being cared for, then probably that's a good thing too. That is open for debate. Some people believe that actually undertaking emotional labour is unethical. Does it matter for the health professional? Yes. And that's partly for the health professional as an individual, but partly for the effect it might have on patient care. So emotional work is associated with emotional distancing. You're more likely to distance from your patients, you're less likely to get involved with your patients, so therefore you're not going to be able to provide holistic care. You may not be considering their spiritual needs. It's associated with a lack of professional, personal integrity and a feeling of a lack of authenticity. So you may be in a situation where you're doing something professionally that you don't necessarily agree with, and certainly for this dietitian, her professional integrity was related to her faith. So she was doing something that really she felt uncomfortable with. So that lack of authenticity, that lack of being true to herself, was troubling for her. It can be associated with moral distress, that feeling of doing something that you really don't want to be doing, that you don't agree with. It's associated with stress, burnout, emotional exhaustion, we've just been hearing about, depersonalization, feeling of lack of accomplishment, lack of effectiveness, and so on, and will have an effect on patient care. You're more likely to have errors of judgment, be negative, callous, be detached to the emotional aspects of the job. And the emotional aspects will include someone's spiritual care. Emotional work is also associated with increased rates of burnout and higher rates of absenteeism, low patient satisfaction and higher staff turnover. Does it matter that she didn't disclose her faith? I think yes. Decision making should be transparent. It should be discussed with the patient as well as the wider healthcare team. Now, a dietitian may not make the decision directly, but they will be part of the team, should be part of the team that discusses those decisions. And if someone's faith is affecting where a decision is going, then perhaps that should be discussed. And we know that faith does influence decisions about artificial nutrition and hydration. So perhaps not disclosing her faith wasn't best for transparent decision making. So, faith does influence decisions and feelings about you feeling in difficult situations. Hiding personal religious beliefs due to fear of professional repercussions can lead to emotional work. Undertaking emotional work can affect the patient and the healthcare professional, and there may be issues with transparent decision making, but I'm not quite finished yet. A couple more slides, I know it sounds like it. So, implications for practice. As I said, one person's account. So I'm very much couching this is just one person's account. However, I think this may well resonate with other people. We do need to discuss our emotions more. I think particularly in the UK, we're not very good at discussing how we feel about the decisions that are made and the situations that we find our patients in. And training and supervision can be helpful as far as managing our emotions. And there is some evidence to show that there is a difference between deep and surface acting. So if there are terms you haven't heard of before, surface acting is that putting on a mask. It's that faking it, you're not feeling the true emotion inside, you're just expressing emotion because you think that's what you should do. So being happy for a patient, caring for a patient, feeling happy when someone gives you a present, whether you like that present or not. Deep acting is being described as more similar to method acting. So you're trying to remember a time when you had that emotion personally, a real emotion, and you try to remember how you felt in that situation, and you draw on that to show the right emotion in front of the patient. And you can do more deep acting with training. And that makes a difference because surface acting is associated more with those negative effects for healthcare professionals. The deep acting is associated with more positive effects of personal accomplishment, job satisfaction, and positive effect on decision making between doctors and patients. So, personal faith can lead to hiding of emotions, particularly in the UK. Emotion work has an influence, may have an influence on quality of patient care and risk of burnout for health professionals. Perhaps we need more training, more thinking about our emotions, and more training to enable us to deep act more, and not disclosing faith may have an effect on decision making. Okay, I've got quite a few pages of references. I'd like to thank my participants. The dietitians I interviewed were fantastic. They gave me wonderful data and told me some fantastic things. My two PhD supervisors and Coventry University for funding my PhD. Thank you.
Thanks a lot for this nice presentation. Really emotion-wrecking presentation. Maybe there are questions.
Yeah. Denise, I noticed that you use the term caring and emotion. There it struck me that you could use
the terms conviction and judgment. And I wonder what you think is at stake in why the language of feeling when you're talking about people's, or when you could describe someone's feeling as part of or as flowing from their conviction that a certain activity is good or bad.
I partly used the word feelings and emotions because it was a theme for my PhD, and some of the feelings and emotions people had weren't specifically rooted in a faith or a belief. It was more their concern for patients, the concerns that perhaps decisions weren't what they thought was right, that wasn't necessarily rooted in what they expressed as a faith. So it seemed to sum up better the range of experience that the dietitians told me.
A sense that something is not right, so set aside the religious convictions, is if that's the source of the emotion, that's quite different than the source of the emotion being something like, I'm tired, I'm scared that my mother's going to die, I'm thinking about that, and so I'm reacting. So if someone is angry because they believe something is wrong,
mm-hmm.
then it seems to me the answer is not do emotion work. The answer is, or at least not obviously, the answer may be figure out a way to act in a new way.
Yeah.
Find a way to act in such a way that you can act with a clear conscience or with a sense of that this work is now good that I'm doing.
Yeah, and one of my other findings is really related to the struggle dietitians have with being heard in that decision-making process. So the dietitians that were being heard and their emotional responses were more positive didn't seem to undertake emotional work in the same way. It was the dietitians who were perhaps more junior, who were implementing decisions made from other people. They were trying to be heard but weren't, were the ones that were undertaking the emotional work and having the negative responses. So I think it's probably related to power, to hierarchy, and you know, the dietitians needed to be out there more.
And obviously, obviously the dietitians and the staff have done and respond to the patient's needs. But my query is this: who's going to take care of the, I would say, spiritual and also professional conflictual issues of the dietitian themselves? Because just hearing you, I could feel the tension. The tension of being disciplined, the tension of being kicked out of work of the dietitians themselves. Because I cannot work in a hospital setting if I myself am being haunted, so to say, by an invisible disciplinary action which is following me all the way. So how can these dietitians work in peace, really? With their conscience, peace with the patients, peace with the whole setup of the hospital.
Yeah. And it's something I did ask my participants about, you know, did they talk to anybody about this, did they have any supervision, did they reflect on it? And supervision within dietetics should be happening, but it's something that tends to fall by the wayside when people are busy, when people are understaffed. You know, dietitians are caring people and they want to put their patients first, and sometimes they're not always thinking about their own needs. But yeah, it is an issue.
Thank you very much for your presentation. It struck a chord because, as an ethicist, I've worked with dietitians that struggle with this all the time. And I was going to just ask two questions. One you've already asked. It's about inclusion in decision-making processes, because they're often not in family meetings in many hospitals. And there would be a concern for that, actually.
Mm.
And then secondly, I just wondered, there are some strategies to ethically debrief clinicians,
mm-hmm.
so that there can actually be an exploration of whatever the feelings or convictions are,
mm-hmm.
and perhaps to also allow them some time in a non-judgmental way to come to terms with what is going on. So
yeah.
Two comments, but thank you very much for an excellent presentation.
And I think it's partly related to seniority. The more senior dieticians had were more involved in a team, so they were accepted as a member of that team, they communicated better in the team, and the team supported each other. So they did have more of that informal support network and talking to each other about it. One of my participants said, sometimes you just say, give me a hug, and that's all she needed. But the junior dietitians, their workload is a lot higher, they're covering far more wards, they're involved with lots of teams, and they're maybe not supported in the same way as the seniors who are involved in perhaps just one specialist team.
Denise, Dr. Reisley from Coventry, I've got a question for you, but I think I might be repeating that previous question. Surely the key issue for somebody of faith in the NHS these days is the potential that they could be persecuted for their beliefs.
Well, she was keeping it quiet. She was concerned about her job. She was concerned that she would get called up in front of our professional association and would get struck off.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
So isn't the onus not on her, but on the authorities? I mean, surely she's taking a great risk in taking that on personally, that issue of being out there and deep acting, as you're talking about.
Mm. Well, she was surface acting because she was emotionally working. She was struggling. And perhaps if she was deep acting, she would have coped better.
But when you say deep acting, do you mean that she should still conceal her faith, or do you think that she should bring it out?
As I said, I think it's something that should be discussed openly. I think we're not good at doing that in the UK.
But she will get persecuted for it.
Well, hopefully, by nature of being here and thinking about, you know, supporting patients' spiritual needs, we also need to be thinking about, health professionals as well.
Yeah.
You know, things will change slowly. I'm not expecting her to say tomorrow, but, you know, if we're hoping that our students are thinking more about spirituality, as we've heard from lots of speakers, they may well be thinking more about themselves as well as their patients. So, you know, with time.
Okay.
One last one.
Great presentation. Lynn Vanderpump from the University of Aberdeen. Yesterday we heard from Ewan Kelly, mm-hmm. and he talked about these ideas of ritual and routine, and I was just thinking about emotion work in the context of ritual and routine, and I wonder if you could comment, because it, to me it seems like it could go either way into both of those categories.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, it's something I thought about after listening to the session yesterday. And I think the dietitians that were more distancing and becoming more blasé to their patients' needs, it was routine. You know, they weren't being affected by what was going on, and that was their way of coping. And that concerned me a little bit, that, you know, that distancing meant they weren't connecting with their patients. And perhaps, you know, thinking more about the ritual of it, and, you know, that this is something important for the patient, rather than it being routine for a health professional. Yeah. I also had a chat with Ewan after his session, and he was saying that one of the key things was that a lot of the chaplains did show their emotions to their bereaved parents, which I thought was very interesting.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I think it's a very important topic also for doctors. Okay, we are coming to our last presentation. That's not any pizza. Oh, wow. Okay, then you have to hurry up, huh? I didn't see that. Okay, the next one is Patricia Ayres. She's a lecturer in occupational therapy at the Faculty of Health Science, Health and Human Science, Plymouth University, UK. And she's going to talk about religious practice in occupational need. Please.
Thank you very much, Renee. And I'm going to be really, really quick to make sure that I give my colleagues some time as well. I'm from Plymouth, and I'm going to talk to you a little bit about occupation and occupational needs and religious practice and engagement in those terms. So I had planned to talk to you a little bit about the definition of occupation and occupational science, the research area that I work in. I'm going to do that really, really quickly so I can get on to talk about my study. We think about occupations as occupational therapists in terms of everything that we do. I'm not talking about a job of work, I'm talking about everything that each of us do, from the minute we get up in the morning to the minute we go to bed at night. So absolutely everything. And clearly for some of us, those everyday things that we do include engagement in religious activities and actually expressing our religious faith. So what do occupational therapists do? Well, they help people to engage in those very valuable and everyday occupations, which again, for some people, includes engagement in religious expression and worship. I learned early on in my research that the word worship doesn't necessarily travel across faiths as easily as one might expect, so I tend to say religious practice. And occupational therapists will often express their work in terms of a very basic philosophical approach, doing, being, becoming, and belonging. So doing the things that we do, being, that is to say, the person, but also an expression of that that exists outside of the person. Becoming the occupations that we aspire to do, and those things that we change over time from childhood through adulthood into older age. And lastly, belonging, that we very often engage in these occupations, not individually, but in groups, in families, in various different relationships. We've heard other people say, you know, no man is an island. So occupational science looks at how we address occupations. What are the occupations? What do we need to know about occupations in order to help our patients and our clients through difficult times and to engage in the things that are important to them? And again, I would say that one of those important areas can be religious practice. The sort of things that we need to understand about any occupation, and you can look at this slide in relation to religious practice, are listed here. This comes from some work from New Zealand, from Claire Hocking. But it looks at the number of different areas that we might need to understand in relation to this occupation of religious practice. I'm going to go really quick. There is spirituality in the occupational therapy and the occupational science literature. It exists throughout. But in actual fact, looking at religion in terms of the things that people do that are really important to them is absent from the literature in the area that I work in. Two of my favourite photographs. I had to fit them in somewhere. So clearly, as a therapist, there are lots of resources that one can go to. My students, my colleagues, we can all look for information about different religious practices that may fall outside of our experiences and our understanding. And that's very true. With the internet, we can look and find information. But these types of areas of information actually struggle in many ways to resemble the lived experience. I'm a Christian, I'm an Anglican, and if I look at these sort of explanations of Christianity, yes, I recognise the dates and the ceremonies and the key parts of my faith, but it doesn't tell me about my lived experience. It doesn't tell me, and come back from the page or the computer, what it actually feels like for me and what are the things that I do that are really important. So healthcare practitioners, OTs in particular, are often very fearful of this. They feel they can't engage on an occupational level with their client if they don't have any understanding or any personal experience. And they feel, I'm a Christian, I will really struggle to work with a client who's a Muslim or who's Jewish. And they tend to make assumptions. The literature tells us that we very often make assumptions. Somebody dealing with myself, maybe as a patient, will say, perhaps a Christian, therefore it must be really important that she goes to church on Sunday morning. And that may or may not be important to me. It's an assumption that we too readily make sometimes. I'm going to skip over this one. This is about looking at cultural competence, and I'll come on to that in a minute too. So I'm interested in occupational knowledge, our knowledge base. Religious practice isn't represented, certainly for me in my sphere of practice. And I'm looking at multi-faith cultural issues across lots of different faith groups. So what I'm looking at really is asking people from different faith communities to express to me the meaning of their everyday engagement. So again, moving away perhaps from the more obvious engagements, but the things that are personally meaningful for them in terms of the things that they do. And then I'm going to move on. I'm really only not even halfway through my project at the moment. As I've said, the literature doesn't exist. I won't dwell on this slide, but certainly I've been influenced by the work of James Fowler, looking at the development of faith across time in terms of the different occupations that people engage in over their lifespan, and also the work of Tonston looking at gerotranscendence. If you haven't come across this body of work, then I recommend it to you. It's very, very interesting in terms of spirituality in older age. So I'm using a qualitative methodology, looking phenomenologically at the lived experience of people, as you might expect from what I've already said, and valuing people's experience as another body of research data, really, that's very important to us. But I struggled a little bit at the beginning of my project to really feel that interviews and focus groups and the sort of things that are commonly done would be able to really give me the data from the people that I really wanted to talk to. And it's something that qualitative researchers struggle with frequently, I know. Do we hear the loud voice? Do we hear the confident voice? Do we hear the voice that bounces back at us in terms of people telling us what they expect us to want to hear? So I chose a different path, and I'm using a visual methodology, a modified photo voice methodology. Again, time I think prevents me from going into detail, but if anyone wants to catch up with me later, I'm very happy to talk about photo voice. And basically, my participants in my study each have taken photographs that represent their religious practice, the things that they do, and then I've interviewed them when they talk to me, not actually about religious practice. They've just talked to me about the photographs that they've taken, which means that the interviews are very, very reflective. These are participants so far. We've done one phase of recruitment and one phase of photograph taking and interviews, and we're about to launch on another. So it's a very mixed group of people, mixed ages, the youngest 18, the oldest 80. So far we've just looked at basic thematic analysis, but the plan is to actually delve much deeper into the data. But to date there are some themes that emerge quite loudly from the data, looking at the significance of place, some narrative histories, the role of objects, artifacts, material things, and space for contemplation. Some people do talk about the place that they use, we would say maybe say for worship, like the church or the mosque or whatever. This is a quote from a Buddhist participant talking about one of the places that he finds really helpful for meditation. But interestingly, people also talk about all sorts of other places. This is one of the Christian participants who talks very much, she's about her grandmother, but nevertheless her photograph and a lot of what she was saying were talking about the place, and this was actually her grandmother's greenhouse, and this place was very important to her in terms of expressing her religious needs, and she would go to this place frequently. People talked in stories. They gave me stories about their religious engagement, not just necessarily about what they had done during the period they were taking photographs, but sometimes about other things from the past. So there were lots of stories. This was a Hindu participant who talked about the need to celebrate Diwali as a community with lots of other people, but being the only Hindu in his community, so therefore needing to share with lots of other people. And this was, again, this was about the belonging, really, needing to be in a group of people. As I said, the role of objects, artifacts, material things, and again, some things that you would expect. This Christian participant, maybe you would expect to think of, possibly of a candle, maybe even of the statue from Amaramagal, but not necessarily the glass lotus flower. That was unusual, but very important to this person. And we've heard at other points today about people who had objects around their bed or something that were very important. Space for contemplation. Contemplation is my word, not participant's word. They either use the word prayer or meditation or sometimes just a space to think. But nevertheless, out of each participant, pretty much across the board, people were talking in these terms. And all of these photographs are the ones the photographs that people took, by the way. I didn't make that clear. So in terms of looking at this across space, there were a lot of themes that came across. It didn't seem to matter whether you were Christian or Jewish or Hindu. There were some very themes that came out that were very compatible, really. So we're now going to take that forward, and we're going to look with OTs and some hospital chaplains at whether that can inform the way that people take spiritual histories and really do some work in terms of maybe some confidence building for people when they're engaging with people from other faiths. So some thank yous there. Just to say that we're going to have a photographic exhibition as part of Interfaith Week later this year in the UK, and there will be a body of photographs and some narratives. So if anyone feels like putting on an exhibition, just let me know. They'll be available.
Thank you, Patricia, for this very beautiful talk.
So we're coming to our last presentation. That's Melanie Rogers. She's a senior lecturer for advanced nursing practitioners, also in the UK. We have a UK group. Please go on.
Okay, I will try and talk very fast, but it's a little bit of a confusing concept that I'm going to discuss, so do grab me afterwards if there's any questions. I'm from the University of Huddersfield, and some of you may know it. It's a very well-renowned university, a very small university in the north of England. It's something that you probably never heard of, but you may have heard of Patrick Stewart, who is our Vice-Chancellor, and James Mason, and the Yorkshire Terrier is one of our famous areas. This, in the middle, this is the university. This is Yorkshire pudding. I will talk to you about Yorkshire pudding over dinner. So I have completed a hermeneutic inquiry of the spiritual dimensions of nurse practitioner consultations, and I've done this in primary care but through the lens of availability and vulnerability. For those who don't know what a nurse practitioner is, in the UK they take on a very similar role to the general practitioner, so the whole plethora of patients may come through with undifferentiated and undiagnosed conditions. Okay. And what I've done is a concept analysis of spirituality in primary care. I've undertaken a hermeneutic phenomenological inquiry into the actual spiritual dimensions of the consultation, and then I've looked at it through the lens of availability and vulnerability. And it's through Gadamer. I'm not going to talk about hermeneutic inquiries, but it's about the lived experience and the qualitative voice of the practitioners. So I've interviewed 8 experienced advanced nurse practitioners, and that was between 1 and 2, 18 months and 2 years apart. They all work in primary care, and they're a slightly older group, as you'd expect. Most of these have been nursing for 10, 15 years before they've gone on to do advanced practice. I didn't ask specifically about their faith belief, but that was something that came out in interviews. Some had a faith belief, some didn't. And as we've talked about already throughout the conference, there's a huge confusion for practitioners about spirituality and religion. Sometimes these were conflated, but all of the practitioners talked to them about what they felt spirituality was. So listening to the patient, presencing, taking time, being self-aware as a practitioner, being compassionate. Okay, so I can slow down. Okay, right. Phew. Okay, so they also talked about boundaries, and that's something that I'll come back to. For these practitioners who are working in an autonomous way, the boundary wasn't always set, and they talked about that this boundary would move backwards and forwards, and they would interpret this depending on the relationship with the patient, and we'll come back to that. They all talked about seeing patients over a period of time. So most people working in primary care may see a practitioner over a period of 10, 15, 20 years. So they may know the patient, they may know their family, they may know friends in the community. And this changed the relationship. And there was something about the more the practitioner felt comfortable with the patient and the relationship, the more they may be willing to share of themselves. But that was within a boundary. And the terminology was very interesting. It's already been talked about that the UK is becoming more of a secular society. And some of the practitioners talked about that patients would have talked about many of the issues that they brought up in the consultation previously with a priest or clergy 10, 15, 20 years ago, but that they were now bringing these issues to the practitioner. So some of the participants talked about themselves in the role of the minister. They talked about themselves as spiritual healers. They talked about their work as vocation, and they also talked about patients coming to see them with a diagnosis of soul ache. This was particularly one participant, and she talked very much about her role as a spiritual healer and how she didn't say to a patient, "You have soul ache," but this was something that she purposely looked for with patients. And the times when practitioners recognised a spiritual dimension had occurred, often when there were existential issues, as you'd imagine, depression, fear, but patients who came with multiple presentations, or patients, it just seemed to happen, so they may have come in for a consultation about something relatively minor. So these were just some of the terms that the practitioners talked about with spirituality. They talked about it as something that was innate for them. It was the way they chose to live, the way they chose to care, that it was something that was always there. Whereas other practitioners had no idea what spirituality meant. They weren't really sure why they'd actually agreed to take part in the interview, and they really found it hard to understand what spirituality was. They found it hard to put words to it. But 18 months later, they seemed to have a little bit of a better understanding about it and had thought about it more over the 2-year period. So, not only did I decide to look at spirituality, which in the UK, especially with nurse practitioners, seems to be a little bit of a dirty word. People seem to have a bit of a reaction about spirituality. So I made it difficult for myself in terms of ethics. It took me 2 years to go through ethics because of some of the medical concern about the use of spirituality. But I then decided, okay, let me add in availability and vulnerability, which is a rule that has come from a Celtic Christian new monastic community. So you can imagine what a lot of the clinicians in the ethics panel thought of me when I decided to bring this in. Anyway, in the UK, in Northumbria, this is a very small, dispersed community which is looking at a fresh expression of Christianity and trying to live out an authentic expression of Christian faith through a dispersed setting. It is an open community. You can become a friend, you can become a companion, you can become a visitor, and it's very much embedded in the Northumbria culture, which, for those who haven't been to there, is a very wild, woolly environment, and Holy Island is probably one of the focal points within the Northumbria community. Okay, so like other monastic traditions, they have a rule of life, and their rule of life is made up of two vows, that of availability to God and others and intentional, deliberate vulnerability before God and others. And the idea about this is not being something rigid. It's supposed to be provocative but not prescriptive, and it's supposed to be a framework of freedom. So they would never tell you how to live these vows out in your own life. It's for you to work out within your faith, within your life, within your relationships, within your work. So this was something that was very important to me. I'd been part of the community for the last 18 years, but I wanted to look at how I could be more available and more vulnerable as a practitioner, and to see what other people thought about these terms. So I didn't actually tell anybody why I was coming to them in the interviews with these concepts, but in the first interview I asked them about what spirituality meant for them, what was important in their practice, and I asked them what the terms available and vulnerable meant, and they talked about that. 18 months later, I gave them a booklet which talked about the Northumbria community, which was part of the ethical, condition of me carrying out the research. I actually wouldn't, in hindsight, have wanted to give them this booklet because it's confusing. It confuses me, and I have a faith. But they had to read this booklet, and it talked about what availability and vulnerability meant. Okay, so from the rule of life, availability is about the bedrock of the faith and about how to live in day-to-day living. And one of the questions that follows choosing to be available in your life is about how should I live? And the importance of marrying availability and vulnerability is about how to fully connect with others. Obviously, vulnerability is usually seen as weakness, and I had a very interesting response that I did to what spirituality meant about vulnerability. Most practitioners felt availability was something they wanted to do. They wanted to give time to their patients, they wanted to sit and listen to their patients, they wanted to be, as a clinician, open to their patients. However, vulnerability, lots of the practitioners talked about times when they might get hurt. So they talked about emotionally being hurt, physically being hurt. The stories they often shared were about times when they'd had deep conflict, deep distress by a consultation. Something had happened. They talked in lots of experiences about stories where they had actually connected to a patient and that had hurt them. So one of the practitioners talked about a homeless man who she'd spent many years building a relationship with, and she'd seen him get knocked down outside of her practice on a busy road. Another practitioner talked about a time when she'd been attacked by one of the patients she'd built a relationship up with. But the idea for me about vulnerability is not about just standing there willy-nilly, letting somebody walk all over you, having no boundaries, just saying, here I am, use me to whatever your need is. It's about creating a place for freedom and connection with another. So sharing something of ourselves to enable somebody to move forward, to give somebody hope, meaning and purpose. And many of my patients who I cared for, especially with depression, they'd lost hope. So I wanted to use a concept that would help people to move forward. And Jean Vanier talks about vulnerability in terms of giving people a place of safety, helping them to feel loved and accepted, being able to lift their masks and being vulnerable. Okay, so this is the summary of the community. So being available to God and others, being available to others in the call to hospitality, being available to others in terms of participation in care and concern, and being available to mission. Vulnerability is about being teachable, being able to take the heretical imperative, so speaking out when we think something isn't right, being willing to ask the hard questions, being willing to live with uncertainty, and being willing to live without a church without walls. And from the research, what I've been able to do is reconceptualize this, and what I would postulate is that availability and vulnerability is a way to really embed spirituality in our practice. So first of all, being available to ourselves, and I'd say this would be for all clinicians, so about being self-reflective, self-accepting, and embracing spirituality in however you deem to define that, but for me, thinking about meaning, purpose, and hope as a key to our inner journey. To be welcoming to our patients, giving time, acceptance, and understanding whilst being truly present and listening attentively. And this is difficult. In primary care, we have 10 minutes to make a diagnosis, to take a history, make a diagnosis, prescribe, refer, to do all the things that we need to do as a practitioner, and then we're saying we want to bring in spirituality. But I would argue within 10 minutes you can still be present, you can still listen, you can hear the patient's story. To offer care and concern for our patients through active participation, giving the patient a safe place to tell their story, and being available to develop our practice however we need to do within the community that we work. And vulnerability. So for me, this is about being teachable, not expecting that we will ever know it all, being willing to live with uncertainty. I have no issue in saying to a patient, I'm not sure what's going on here. I'm going to refer you on to somebody, or I'm going to see you in a couple of weeks, and let's just see how things are progressing. Being willing to be accountable for our practice, admit our mistakes and accept constructive criticism, to be willing to be an advocate for our patient, and to be willing to be vulnerable and authentic in our interactions with patients, thinking about patients' best interests as the end point, and to be willing to be challenged and questioned without defensiveness. Okay, so finally I kind of tried to bring the two together. So for me, spirituality appears to be about fundamental humanness and is acknowledged as being innate. Availability and vulnerability is deeply concerned with humanness. Many see spirituality as intangible. Availability and vulnerability can make spirituality more tangible and more practical in the clinical setting. Spirituality is about humanness, as is availability and vulnerability. It involves a level of risk. And there is always within availability and vulnerability the risk of being hurt and misunderstood. Spirituality is about should be integrated into the way we care, and availability and vulnerability can enhance the way we care into authentic practice. I must say spirituality, although it's innate, we can choose to embrace it or to ignore it. But with availability and vulnerability, the choice we make is intentional. So we intentionally determine that we're going to bring spirituality into our care. Okay, I'm not going to talk about boundaries because I'm aware that we're going off time, but this is a concept analysis that I've developed about spirituality, and for me it is, spirituality is innate, it is about our humanness, and it is very much about our being as a practitioner, and within that hopefully we'll have hope and meaning and purpose in our own role, but we'll be wanting to connect, we'll be wanting to be compassionate, we'll be wanting to see our work as vocational, and it's our volition to do that. So the who we are, our being, and the being available. We're moving on to then our doing and showing our vulnerability in our practice, so presencing, maybe sharing something of ourselves to be able to help a patient move forward, giving empathy, listening, caring, engaging, investing in others, and giving of our time. Contextually, there are all sorts of issues. Certainly the practitioners I spoke to talked about this was something about their holistic practice. For them it was a ministry and it was about transcendent care. But within that there was tensions. There was tensions in terms of their code of conduct, in terms of their personal values. And many of the practitioners had hit burnout or had experience of burnout and stress. The emotions it evoked for practitioners
was, there was the good emotions, so there was love, hope, meaning, purpose, but a number of practitioners also for themselves experience soul ache, experience hopelessness, experience despair, and a lot of those emotions for practitioner came out in kind of their existential search to be authentic in their practice. So that is a very whistle-stop tour. I just put the final quote on about Vanya, about reaching maturity as you find freedom to be yourself, to claim, accept and love your own story and your own brokenness and beauty. And for me, consistently reflecting on my journey, being authentic is an agent for increased spirituality. And this came through very strongly with the participants and their desire to be compassionate and honest and to really accept themselves as a practitioner in order to practice spirituality. Thank you. So hopefully we're not going to be charged a huge amount for going 5 minutes over, 5 minutes over time.
I don't think so. So thank you for your presentation.
Thank you.
Thank you for sticking to the time. I think there will be one question. I think you could. Okay, one last one.
Whether or not it's wise, who knows? But for me, this is very much about bringing my faith journey very back to the basics and thinking about these concepts in terms of how we truly connect to our patients. And spirituality for the participants was very difficult for them to conceptualise. Availability and vulnerability, although vulnerability had its challenges, it seemed to mesh quite easily for the practitioners and would help them to conceptualise for themselves, well, how can I actually practice spirituality within the consultation? And these were some tools that they felt comfortable enough to carry forward. Thanks.
Thank you.
Thank you.